Okay, so before I start, I wanted to do something that a fellow, a piece of program that a fellow gave me last week. She said to breathe in God and breathe out self, and that's kind of what I'm doing right now in my program. So I'm going to breathe in God and breathe out self. Thank you all so much for being here. OA has entirely changed my life. My last binge was exactly 1 year ago, after a bicycling accident that I had. I was biking to yoga, and I wasn't wearing a helmet. I had my yoga mat rolled up in my backpack and was just like 2 minutes away from the studio, and a door flew out, and I smashed into it, and I fell back onto my yoga mat, and I could have hit my head, and I could have seriously injured myself if it hadn't been for that. And because I was in my restrict binge cycle, I got up. He said he was so sorry. I said, it's okay. And I was a little bit in shock. I finished biking to yoga, and I did yoga, despite the fact that my ankle was killing me. And then I biked home in the dark, and then I went home and I binged. Because in my disease, I use food to cope with my emotions. Whatever emotions they were, whether I was upset about a traumatic event that had happened, like that night, or embarrassed, or angry, or sad, depressed, anxious, all of the things, even happy, I ate because food was my coping mechanism. And I truly believe I was born with this disease. I was born a compulsive overeater. A lot of my childhood memories have to do with food. When I was 2 years old, I was diagnosed with leukemia. And I have a distinct memory of this, like, platter of cookies, in front of me in the oncologist's office. And I remember the obsession. Even then, I was probably, like, I don't even know, 4, 5 years old, going through chemo or just having finished chemo. And I wanted one of each type of cookie. And I remember, like, I had one of each, and then I decided which ones were my favorite. And then I wanted to go back for each of my favorites, and I wanted to savor, like, my favorite for last. And by the time my mom realized what I was doing, she was like, okay, honey, that's enough, just one more. And I don't think she realized how many I had eaten, and she certainly didn't understand that I was obsessed with these treats, with the sugar, and sugar was totally my thing. I brought some photos to kind of pass around. Like I said, I think I was born with this disease. By the time I was 8 or 9, I started to gain weight because I was eating compulsively, and I didn't even realize at the time that that's what I was doing. I just knew that I liked the food, and I just wanted to eat the food, and I seemed to eat more food than anyone else, such as my brother or sister. And I started gaining, and I just kept gaining and gaining. You can see, I look like a normal kid for these first few photos, and then probably in this one, 2001, it's time-stamped at the bottom right corner with my 2 siblings. And when I was 9, I got braces, glasses, acne, and started gaining weight and got some pretty awkward boobs. So that was really fun. And from there, from like 9 on, I just kept gaining weight. I brought this photo, which you will see. This was March 2001. We went skiing for the first time as a family, and so I would have been 12 at the time, and so my brother would have been about 10, my sister would have been 7, and then my mom's in the photo. We went skiing, and I had started to internalize all of the shame about my body, about the weight gain. And I was told by my mom, by my aunt, by my grandma that I needed to lose weight, that I just needed to go on a diet. I just needed to eat like a normal person. And I just didn't know how. And with all that shame I carried, I told myself I couldn't do a lot of things such as skiing. So we went on this trip, and I just remember just sitting in the cabin the whole time and like drinking hot cocoa. And like my mom sat with me out of solidarity, but my siblings went out and skied, and I just told myself that I couldn't because I was too fat. And I look really, really miserable in this photo. I'll pass this around shortly. The next photo is me with a ice cream cake. Ice cream cake was our tradition for birthdays. And then this smaller one is my senior picture. So when I was 13, my parents divorced. They fought a lot. And I was actually really happy that they divorced because I was tired of the fighting. And then soon after the divorce, my mom stopped taking the antidepressants that she had been on for decades. And with that shift in medication, she became really depressed. And she had always kind of gone up and down. But she, in a depressive state, she one night she called 911 and told the police that she wanted to kill herself, and she was hospitalized. And she was diagnosed as bipolar. She was hospitalized for a few weeks, and I remember going to visit her, and she looked like a zombie. She was so heavily medicated, and she wasn't herself. And she came back home after a little while, and she still wasn't quite herself. And shortly after, I mean, maybe a few weeks later, this would have been January 3rd, 2004. So in between my semester, my freshman year semesters of high school, she committed suicide. And I was home with her. So I found her. And I was home with her because my dad was a very angry person. He kind of raged at us a lot. He yelled a lot. And this was the first weekend that you know, we would go to my dad's apartment. And I was like, I don't want to go. I just want to not deal with it. I know he's just going to yell at me. I have a specific memory of like he is also a compulsive eater. He bought a package of Oreos, and we were staying at his apartment, and I ate almost all of the Oreos. And I just, at first I was like, I'm just going to have one, or I'm just going to have two. But then I kept going back for the Oreos because, you know, we know as compulsive eaters that we have one bite and it's just never enough, and you just need more and more. And of course I didn't know at the time that that's what was happening. But he saw that I had eaten most of the Oreos, and he raged at me. And so that weekend that my mom died, I told her I didn't want to go to my dad's house, and she said that was okay, and my two siblings did go. So I found her. She had taken all of the pills she could find in the house, including her new antidepressant mood stabilizer medications. And I found her, and I called 911, and I did CPR, and there was nothing I could do at that point. And the ambulance came, and then I called my dad, and he came, and he and I were just like sitting at the table, hoping and praying that they could revive her, but they couldn't. It was too late. And I just remember after the EMT told me that they couldn't revive her, I just remember bawling. Like the tears would not stop. But after that day, I shut it off. And I was already a compulsive eater. But after that tragic day happened, I did not let myself cry for 4 years. I didn't let myself cry at her funeral. Anytime that like the image of like finding her body came up in my mind, I just shut it off. And I ate. And meanwhile, my dad moved back into the house, And unbeknownst to us at the time, he was a meth addict. So he and his girlfriend and his youngest brother, who moved to Denver to live with us, would smoke meth together and drink. And when he was coming off of the drugs, he would rage. He would yell so violently at us. And he was emotionally abusive, and he was physically abusive toward my brother a couple of times. And it was just like living in hell. It was just constant, like never knowing whether whether anything that I would say or do would set him off. He was just so angry. And he would rage for like maybe half an hour, and then he would say sorry and want us to pretend like nothing had happened. So I ate over it. And I wasn't allowing myself to feel anything to deal with my mom's death. And I was so ashamed of my body and had anxiety and depression. And I just ate and ate. I just binged. And I that was my coping mechanism. And by the time I graduated college or high school, I was 272 pounds. I went into the doctor's office to get my immunizations before college. And I hadn't weighed myself in a couple years. And I remember stepping on that scale, and it just kept going up. And I was shocked, because I didn't think it was that bad. And I was so ashamed. And I didn't even apply to any colleges in Colorado. I wanted out, you know, I wanted out of that house. I just wanted to be done. And I decided on the University of Missouri. So I packed up my car and I drove 11 hours east to Missouri, middle of Missouri. And I didn't know anybody. I was really alone. And with that big move, everything came up for me. Everything about my mom came up for me. And I could not feel it. I could not think about it. And I was still in the food. But I couldn't binge in the way that I had been. Like, especially after I got a car. Oh, yes, thank you. Pass those photos around. After I got a car in high school, or driver's license, I could go to the grocery store and I could get my Little Debbie's and my ice cream. Like, those were, sweets were totally my thing. But in college, like, I would go to the dining halls and I couldn't binge in front of everybody. And I started exercising for the first time, really. Because remember, in my childhood and in my teenage years, I told myself I couldn't dance. I was a dancer when I was young before I started gaining weight, but I told myself I was too fat. I couldn't. I got to college and I started on the stationary bike, and then I started on the elliptical, and then I started on the treadmill. And I was exercising to lose weight. And so not only was the binging a factor, but the restriction became a factor, and the overexercise. And I started to lose weight. And I started getting compliments for it. You know, people were noticing. And I realized, oh, if I can lose weight, I could maybe be happy one day. And so I started to lose weight. But I was really depressed, and I was still binging. By the time I was a junior in college, I had lost 70 pounds. So I was just over 200. And then in my second semester of my junior year, I became really depressed and suicidal, and just coursework was really stressful at the time. And I fell back into the food, and I stopped working out as vigorously as I had been. And over the next year or so, I gained back 50 of that. And I graduated college, and I might mention too that self-harm was in my story as well. My freshman year of college, I cut my wrists a little bit just to not feel. And so I graduated college and I moved back home to Colorado and stepped on the scale at the gym and saw that it was 250. I couldn't believe it. And, you know, my net loss was 20. And again, like, internalized all of that shame, and was like, I have to get back on the wagon now. I have to do this right. I have to, you know, again, back to that restriction. And at the same time, I saw a doctor. I hadn't seen a doctor all throughout college because I didn't have health insurance. And she ran my blood, and she saw that I had a thyroid issue. And so this gland in my, in the front of my throat, it's underactive. It doesn't produce enough thyroid hormone. I'm hypothyroid, which means that I'm, you know, my symptoms with that are fatigue, depression, very easy weight gain. And so that was also contributing to like just the misery that I was living in. And so I started getting treatment for that, and I really recommitted to like the exercise and the dieting and calorie counting, and I would obsessively track my calories. And weight loss and body became everything. And it had always been really, it was always everything. And I was able to lose a net of 100 pounds from my heaviest, up until a few years ago, but the weight was kind of going up and down. I would vacillate between like 170 and 190, because I was on that binge restrict cycle, right? I would, think that I could moderate my foods, the sweets for me, maybe just some coconut milk ice cream, for example. And I would say I can just have one serving, and then I would have a serving and it wouldn't be enough. And I would need more, and then I would need more. And then of course the mental obsession comes in, and it's just all I thought about. And so I would binge and then have that sense of relief, right, for 9 seconds, and not have to cope with my emotions. And then immediately that guilt would set in, like, oh my God, I can't believe I ate all of that food. And then I would start to make negotiations with myself. And so for years, especially, in my mid-20s, it was, a lot of restrictions. So the negotiation was like, I would always binge at night after dinner, because I would crave something sweet after dinner, and I would have my binge, and then I would say, okay, I'm not going to eat until 11 a.m. or 1 p.m. or 3 p.m. the next day. And so I would get to work feeling so demoralized and so guilty and so ashamed, and feel like everybody could see it on my body, like see what I had done the night before. And I would hold off as long as possible until I had to eat. And then I would eat a normal meal. And then, of course, that craving would come in again. It's that endless cycle. And throughout all of this, when my mom died, she would have us go to church every Sunday. We were raised Episcopalian. And around the time that she died, I was being confirmed in the church. And when she died, I dropped out. I wanted nothing to do with God. I wanted nothing to do with the church. I became a staunch atheist. And all throughout college, I was very much an atheist. I was like, there's no God. When we die, we die. Like, I was so certain of it. And just the past 3 or so years, that kind of started to shift for me. And I didn't like the word God, especially a male-oriented kind of God. But I started identifying as agnostic. When I went to my very first OA meeting, actually, when I was probably about 22, just coming off of a binge, I went, and this is when I really identified as an atheist, and I heard the word God, and I decided it wasn't for me. I couldn't do it. I couldn't choose a solution that had anything to do with God, because I hated God. I hated God so much that I believed that there wasn't a God. And so I turned away. But that was my very first introduction to OA. And I had to go out there and I had to suffer for another 6 or so years before I was ready. And I did. You know, even though I lost the weight, I lost 100 pounds, I was crazy up here. I was in that constant cycle, and all I thought about was food and body. I mean, any reflection that I passed, I would look at myself and judge myself and see myself the way that I imagined other people would see me. Like, it was entirely obsessive. And then I was in a relationship, and I was with someone who was sober in AA for 15 years, and he encouraged me to start going to Al-Anon because my dad had started drinking again. And my dad, you know, I mentioned he was a meth addict and an alcoholic. He actually got sober in AA when I, around the time that I started college, and we kind of started to repair our relationship. But when we, as a family, when we went to Mexico, I think it'll be 4 years this summer, 4 years ago, he started drinking again. And I kind of struggled with that. So my ex encouraged me to go to Al-Anon, and I had known about AA, I had known about OA, and I went. I went for 4 months consistently, and I was more open to the idea of something spiritual. I still didn't like the word God. I still didn't like that male-oriented, like, omnipotent being. But my mind kind of opened up in a small way to the possibility of some kind of spiritual solution to cope with my trauma and coping mechanisms and the human condition. After he and I broke up in February of last year, I decided that I should see a counselor, a therapist, because the tight hold that I had on my restriction and my food was slipping a little bit, and I was gaining more, and you know, those small vacillations were kind of a little more out of control. So I asked a friend about her therapist, because she talked about her a lot, and she referred me, and I called her therapist, and this was April of last year. And she didn't have any availability, and she referred me to somebody else in her practice. And so I made an appointment, and I wrote on my intake paperwork that I wanted to talk about my binge eating. And that was huge for me, because it was a secret that I had carried for so many years. I didn't share it with anyone. Like, I projected this image of this woman who had successfully lost 100 pounds, like, had the food down, like, knew how to eat well, like, knew how to exercise. Like, I was a nutrition and fitness guru to all of those in my life, but they didn't know that I was binging in secret. So I went into her office, and we had our initial session, and unbeknownst to me, she had decades of experience working in eating disorders. And she was like, somebody's looking out for you. And so April 9th was the date that I went to see her. And she told me I was going to go to OA. And because I had been to Al-Anon, because my eyes had been open maybe just a little bit to the possibility of some kind of spiritual solution, I said yes. And I went to my first, well, technically second OA meeting ever on May 2nd of last year, the day after that bicycling accident. And it was a speaker meeting. It was Amy's speaker meeting. And I kept coming back. And it has changed my life. Truly. So I found a sponsor, probably in late May or June. And, she really understands the steps and the big book and how we work the steps in the big book. And we started working the steps, and, we went to a big book retreat in Estes Park in September together. And just the way that the speaker described, like, broke down the big book and the doctor's opinion in the big book, and the fact that we have, as compulsive eaters, we have, or addicts, any addicts, we have the allergy of the body, and that means that when we have, when I have a bite of my trigger food, it's all I think about. It's never enough. My body craves more and more and more of it. Like, a normal eater could have one bite of a chocolate cake and be fine. Push the plate away and say, that's too rich, I don't need that. For me, it's like, I eat the entire thing, and then I want more, and I obsess, and I'm like, okay, what other sweets can I eat? And so to understand that I have that abnormal physical reaction, and the mental compulsion, the mental twist, that it's that obsessive thinking around my addictive substance. To understand that twofold illness, and just have her explain that in that way was mind blowing for me. It's like, finally, like, I understand, like, what is happening here. And that was incredible to hear. And that same weekend that we went on that retreat, I completed my inventory, my step four. I want to talk a little bit about the steps and how I've worked them. I had this revelation in a meditation class, months ago. I was lying there in Savasana and I was saying the serenity prayer in my head, and prayer is huge for me in my program. That, you know, when I'm feeling anxiety, and I've really dealt with anxiety, and it's so much better now than it has ever been. But when I do feel anxiety come up, I use the prayers in the program and from the big book. And so I was saying the serenity prayer to myself, you know, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And then I distilled that down to serenity, acceptance, courage, and wisdom, just those words. And I kind of had this revelation that serenity is abstinence, acceptance is steps 1 through 3, courage is steps 4 through 9, and wisdom is steps 10 through 12. And that's kind of how I think of this, how I work the steps, and in conjunction with the serenity prayer, and that has been instrumental to me. When I came in on May 2nd of last year, I was at step one. I was ready. I was just ready to be done. I was willing to go to any lengths. I was willing to do exactly what I was told, and I did. My therapist put me on a food plan, and I did resist it for a few weeks because I was like, I studied nutrition. Like, I did a 9-month nutrition program. Like, I'm a nutritional therapy consultant, and I was like, I know everything about nutrition. I don't need to do a food plan. But I didn't realize I was eating every 2 hours, and I was addicted to sweets. And so I got on her food plan and I was ready. I was at step one, that moment that I walked into that speaker meeting a year ago. When it came to step two, I would not use the word God at first. But I used the word trust. That was my word. It just had to be something greater than me. Just something that I could surrender to and just understand, like, this is not under my control, and just have this belief that this power greater than me can restore me to sanity. And then step three is turning over my fears and anxieties, my food, over to my higher power. And then when step four was the inventory, I started slow at first, and I procrastinated a lot at first, but that weekend up in Estes Park, I finished my inventory. And a lot came up for me, but it was truly cathartic to really get that all written out. And then I gave it away to my sponsor for step five. And with step five, you know, you lay it all out there, and your sponsor's like, okay, I hear you, I see you. You know, this is valid. This is your life. Like, this is great. You just to be able to share all of that with somebody is truly freeing. And then six is to, six through eight really is identifying the defects wrapped up in all of that inventory, asking God to remove them, and then determining, okay, who do I need to make an amends to? My amends, some are harder than others, but such a sense of freedom whenever I made an amends to somebody, truly like clearing the air, and just this like cleansing breath, is, I guess, how I describe it whenever I would make an amends. And then 10 is like an ongoing amends. So when the selfishness, the resentfulness, the anger, what's the other one? Dishonesty, come up for me, I work kind of like a mini ninth step or mini 4th through 9th step around it. And I clear the air immediately. And so I don't let those resentments build up. And then in step 11 is like a conscious contact with my higher power. And so that's prayer and that's meditation. And that's so important to just continually turn it over to this thing that's greater than me. And step 12, sponsoring. My sponsees are here today. I love them. It's so incredible to walk other women through this. I'm getting emotional about it because I absolutely love it. I just love it so much. And in terms of how I work my program, I mean, I talked about a lot of this, but prayer is huge. Like anywhere where the big book says ask, that's not anywhere, but a lot of places, like that's a prayer, and that's a prayer I can use to connect with my higher power. There's meditation. I go to about 3 meetings a week. I sponsor. I work my steps, of course. I call into a phone meeting just about every morning. I read. I write. I make outreach calls, which is the hardest thing for me because this is a disease of isolation. I do not want to make those calls, but I force myself to. And the thing that I don't want to do is the thing that I need to do. I have my food plan. And I listen to podcasts. This program is the number one priority in my life because staying abstinent and staying recovered and staying sane is the most important thing in my life. And I'm just so grateful that I'm not alone in this anymore. I'm not isolating anymore. I can be me. And I can come into these rooms with people who get it, who have been through their own shit, just like I have, and who are earnestly working, doing this work, just like I am, and that we can all do this together. And yeah, it's a beautiful program, and I'm really grateful that I was willing, that I came in and I was willing to do the work, and that I continue to do the work. And yeah, that I passed.